This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and on this month's show, I'm looking at two animators who are bringing back traditional forms of animation in new and unusual ways. Later in the program, I'm talking to producer Simon Quinn about his work on such feature films as Tim Burton's Frankenweenie and Wes Anderson's The Fantastic Mr. Fox and Isle of Dogs. In these films and throughout his career on TV animation, Simon has mixed stop-motion animation with innovations in puppetry, using new products and new techniques to keep this seminal form of animation alive. However, to start off today's programme, I'm talking to director Richard Squires about his film Doozy. Doozy is an unusual documentary which features animated sequences as it tells the life of the voice actor Paul Lynde, best known for providing the voices of various classic villains in Hanna-Barbera cartoons from the 1970s. The film features interviews with Lynde's colleagues, academics talking about how hard it was for a gay man to navigate the path between a public and personal persona in the 1970s, and animated sequences which feature an analogue for Paul Lynde placed over live-action footage which reenact moments from the actor's life. To give you a flavour of Doozy, here's an extract from the trailer.
Hello, savages!
Where does the character end and the actor begin?
A very good predictor of who's in our in-group and who's in our out-group is whether people speak with the same accent as we do.
A cartoon villain really is characterized by a range of kind of tics. One of the key ones, I think, is always the endless disguises.
And then there's the implication that there is something other and different about these people. They don't enjoy the same carnal and physical delights as the other characters.
Laughter, at one level, is an emotional expression. When people are being positioned as villains, it's quite an effective marker of otherness.
I'll have a cheeseburger and fries. And hold the onions.
I mean, I've been making animation, moving image work, doing the odd performance for kind of, well, over 20 years now. And either, you know, using my own real name, as it were, or, you know, sometimes using kind of pseudonyms such as Let Me Feel Your Finger First. And started off really kind of working with short film and then also making comics. So at one point with Let Me Feel Your Finger First, well, really the beginning of Let Me Feel Your Finger First, it was very much a kind of comic publishing company. And then we decided to actually animate some of the characters, and so these short animated films came about. But kind of in parallel with that, I was also making my own kind of live action work, I suppose. So in many ways, Doozy is really a kind of development from that time, really. It's my debut kind of feature film, so the first time working with something over an hour, really. But, you know, there are certain kind of themes and interests which I suppose have kind of developed over that time. And certainly one of them is combining, you know, animated characters with live action backgrounds.
Well, and also something that occurred to me is that Doozy shares an idea with some of your short films in that it interrogates an aspect of animation. So, for example, in Ontologically Anxious Object...
Organism.
close. The film considers what would it be like for the life of a boulder who's kind of like a bit part actor in various animated shorts. And indeed, there are references to Asterix and Peanuts and other kind of known animated properties. Another short is, what would it be like to be a character who's kind of badly drawn? Does that
change Francis does that change the nature of the character. And then with Doozy, you're kind of examining what is the life like for a voice actor in cartoons when people will know the voice but might not know much about the actor who played them. So in each case, it's kind of sort of an investigation of an aspect of animation that people might not think about normally.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the idea with Doozy really from the beginning was that I found out about this. I used to watch Hanna-Barbera cartoons as a kid. I loved It's the Wolf, which is the cartoon where Paul Lynde voices Mildew Wolf. My dad, you know, used to go around the house repeating the catchphrase, it's the Woolerf, all the time, you know. So I had that in my head from a young age, and I really liked the Hooded Claw, who he also voiced. You know, there was this kind of history aspect to it in some ways. And then about 5 years ago, I found out that Paul Lynde had also voiced what really is the first kind of possibly closeted gay Hanna-Barbera cartoon character. His name is Claude Pertwee, and he's, you know, the kind of... He's absolutely a kind of confirmed bachelor who lives next door to these kind of all-American families. And so that was really a kind of catalyst to, you know, to look further into, you know, what Paul Lynde was cast as, you know, aside from these Hanna-Barbera cartoons, and also really to look at his kind of real-life circumstance. And I suppose to consider how, you know, really to consider this kind of casting process, obviously in the light of, you know, all the kind of stories of, you know, queer kind of representation. But it was really the question as to why did Hanna-Barbera decide to cast, you know, a closeted gay man as these villainous, snidey, acerbic villains. So it very much became about that, but I didn't want to approach it in terms of, okay, I'll make a biopic of Paul Lynde, or I will just kind of make a conventional documentary. I really wanted to bring in a number of different types of techniques, you might say, or approaches, which would take it away from it just being a kind of conventional investigation. And one of the things I decided really early on was to actually create my own animated character, who is Clovis, who is really the star of the film. And he would actually kind of act out or reenact alleged stories from the life of Paul Lynde. But he wouldn't be just a kind of animated version of Paul Lynde. I didn't want that. I wanted to actually create a character who would literally kind of reenact these, you know, these stories in a way to kind of invert the normal process where, you know, the actor is playing the character, but to have the character playing the actor, if you see what I mean.
Because also, I mean, I guess, you know, if you look at American culture in the 70s, he was kind of accepted as a sort of out gay man in the sense that when he appeared on game shows, he very much kind of enacted that role. Yeah. But at the same time, it wasn't a society where it was easy to be out and gay. And so maybe that idea of a kind of slightly malevolent gay presence, you know, who's a sort of predator, as the way that Clovis is shown, kind of like walking the streets looking for young men, is something that you would find as a trope in the 1970s in America.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, of course, there's a huge long history of, you know, the kind of juxtaposition of queer stereotypes and criminal stereotypes, you know, obviously homosexuality being, you know, a crime, you know, back in the 50s is, you know, you get that kind of mixing of things. So I can understand why, you know, in some ways you have people like Paul Lynde who were, you know, I mean, he wasn't out in the sense of the word, you know, as we know it today, but he was very clearly kind of channeling, you know, a homosexual
performance,
absolutely, in things like Hollywood Squares at the time. You know, he was in some ways equivalent to, you know, John Inman, Larry Grayson, those kind of characters who, you know, aren't, it's not completely out, but we're all in on the joke in some ways. Mm. So,
but there's also something slightly tragic about those figures, that they've all been kind of neutered by society.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
allowed to perform this kind of exaggerated gay role on TV, but then in terms of their own lives, they can't be the person that they want to be.
No, absolutely. I mean, he was very much what... well, one of the actors who voices some of the characters in the film, Doozy, Michael Kearns, he's an American actor who I think was probably one of the first gay actors to come out in Hollywood in the 60s. When I was talking to Michael about Paul Lynde, you know, and Michael had actually met Paul Lynde in the 70s, and he was talking about him very much as a castrated clown, and I think that's the sense that you have of him. Someone who, you know, is... It's not really pre-Stonewall, it's about the time of Stonewall, but they're very much... They feel castrated. They don't feel that they can, you know, they can be completely out. And, you know, you get really the sense with Paul Lynde that he's someone who had enormous kind of difficulties, not only dealing with Hollywood in the 60s, you know, homophobic Hollywood in the 60s, but also, you know, the relationship, the kind of tension between his public and private lives is something which is really, really clear, you know, when you find out about him, and, you know, hopefully is also kind of represented somewhat in Doozy as well.
Mm. You said that you didn't want to do a traditional documentary with this, and I think the way that you've integrated the animation is fascinating, because it's a form that seemed to be at its most popular, I guess, when he was actively doing the voices of cartoons. There were films like Mary Poppins, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Pete's Dragon, all the various Dot and the Australian films in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be something that we rarely get anymore, animation superimposed on live action, and it's something that's kind of really startling as a kind of juxtaposition of two very different forms but works well together. I mean, was it an interest that you kind of wanted to bring that back to the screen, since it's been rarely seen, you know, for a number of years?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm definitely attracted to, you know, things like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and there was the Ralph Bakshi feature, Coonskin, from years ago, which did the same thing. So it's something which aesthetically I really like. Mm. But it was very deliberate for Doozy, in terms of the fact that, again, we wanted this sense of reenactment. So the idea was really to have these 2D characters, Clovis and his group of friends, who would very much... reference that kind of 1960s limited animation Hanna-Barbera style, but then it would be shot present day. So all of the backgrounds were shot in Los Angeles or in San Francisco, present day, I mean literally within the last 3 years, but they were all shot with Super 16 film as well. So the idea was that, you know, the film would actually kind of give it that kind of retro feel, and would refer back to the kind of 60s and 70s, you know, California late night kind of aesthetic, you know. Mm. So there was a very deliberate reason why we used 2D animation and live action. But yeah, it's absolutely something which, you know, I love the look of it anyway, definitely. Yeah.
Well, and I guess particularly for an international audience who wouldn't have watched Hollywood Squares, he's an actor who is only known for his voice. So it kind of makes sense that he's someone that we don't actually see the human physicality of them on screen.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, with originally, obviously, we had the Hanna-Barbera cartoons, which Paul Lynde voiced, you know, in the 60s. And then we had, obviously, the my character, Clovis, who is... reenacting these events in Paul Lynde's life. So we, although Clovis refers to that 1960s animation, it's not exactly the same. It does have a different, slightly different kind of aesthetic. So we had these two different types of animation, and we did try originally in the edit to use some of the original Hanna-Barbera material visually as well as orally. and it just it didn't work. It clashed with the Clovis sections. So in the end, what we decided to do was to use just the audio of the original Hanna-Barbera TV series, but then also to have the you have these kind of close-up, slow-motion images of the various interviewees who are actually kind of watching the Hanna-Barbera and responding to the Hanna-Barbera cartoons. And again, it was the idea was partly to get away from this horrible kind of aesthetic clash between the two different types of animation, but it was also very much to to play with ideas of memory, because often it's, for me, it's the memory of the Hanna-Barbera cartoons that, and it's the memory of the character, which is the really strong thing. Yeah. Actually, when you sit down and you watch them, I mean, they're incredibly formulaic. They're deeply, on one level, although I love the, you know, I love the characters, I love the voices, I love some of the animation. They're actually really quite boring to watch over and over again. So, you know, I think for a lot of people, my age anyway, it's the memory of watching these kind of Saturday morning cartoons, which is so strong. Obviously, if people haven't seen them, it's, you know, the film operates slightly differently. But I wanted to kind of play with that idea of memory.
Mm. Well, and also because with those cartoons, it's not just the visuals that people remember; it is actually the voices. And so once you hear his voice, even if you haven't seen something like Penelope Pitstop for sort of 20-odd years, it kind of has a mnemonic trigger that, oh, my God, it's that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, John Ayerley, who's one of the academics who is interviewing the film, says very clearly, and I think he's right, that, you know, actually you can get away with really quite poorly drawn and executed animation. As, you know, Hanna-Barbera in the 1960s, 1970s, a lot of it was. It was TV animation. It had to be done really quickly. You know, they weren't animating Disney style where every single frame is, you know, rendered individually. They were animating different parts of the body, hence why it's called limited animation. But that actually is an aesthetic which I really, really enjoy and I like. But, you know, it does mean that, you know, it's a different kind of thing in some ways. Yeah.
And I guess also some of those Hanna-Barbera cartoons, even though there are modern equivalents like The Simpsons in terms of it being like a half-hour, you know, animated sitcom, don't seem to be repeated as much. They don't seem to have as much of a cultural legacy, except, I guess, adverts in this country where they'll nick a bit of the Flintstones or Topcatch or sell, you know, insurance. Yeah. So in a way, you're kind of reevaluating and reinvestigating a kind of part of animation history that is starting to fade from memory.
Well, I think, you know, what's important to remember is that in the mid 70s, I might be getting this wrong, you know, Hanna-Barbera had an audience of over 300 million people worldwide.
Okay.
So they had an enormous monopoly on, you know, television animation production. So, if you know, what always struck me was the fact that, you know, all of this stuff which I've kind of consumed as a kid, you know, is all of this is being, you know, is infiltrating kids' psyches, you know, around the world. And, you know, their ideas of family, of suburbia, of villainy, you know, are things which we've kind of, or I've, you know, I'm one of those people who has kind of consumed all of that. So it seems ripe for reevaluation, you know, in some ways.
Yeah. Well, and also, I guess, for gay men our age, if they remember watching those cartoons as a kid, and certainly when I was young, I remember things like the Flintstones and Top Cat seem to be repeated endlessly on TV, even though they're not anymore. If, you know, in your formative years, you would watch one of the cartoons that Paul Lynde voiced, and there seemed to be this sort of equation of the gay voice being slightly sinister, it must have had some kind of impact, you know, on the current generation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I mean, I think it's a very double-edged thing in a way, because, you know, of course, you know, the kind of history of queer representation, you know, has brought all of this to the surface. And, you know, we understand that, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, there were all of these queer villains on the screen, and that, you know, in some ways it's a very negative way to, you know, to represent homosexuality. But for me, in another way, you know, I mean, I think that Paul Lynde was... His voice is probably one of the best voices for any Hanna-Barbera character, actually. And so, you know, in current times when, you know, a lot of gay culture seems to be more about kind of assimilating, you know, there's a part of me which actually feels like, actually, I like this kind of queer villainy, and I want to, I don't want to lose sight of that somehow. Yeah. I want to hold on to some of that. And I do like feeling like an outsider. I do like that aspect of it. So it's not for me a simple thing of it's certainly not a moralistic kind of reevaluation of things and saying this is this, look at this, wasn't this all terrible. It's actually, it's a complex thing. And, you know, there are good and bad sides to it for me.
Well, and obviously, you know, as a kid and as an adult, the kind of extreme archness of his performance is still actually very enjoyable.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, he's got the most amazing voice. He's got the most amazing timing. He's, you know, the way that he kind of injects subtext into these characters and obviously plays to, you know, in some sense they're characters for kids, but of course he's playing to a whole kind of adult audience. You know, he's bringing all of his kind of TV persona and you're getting all of this amazing subtext. So for me, it's just, you know, he's really kind of, his voice work, I think, you know, I mean, I think he's one of these people really who, despite the fact that, you know, when he was in the, you know, mid-60s, he was hugely popular on American TV. He was earning enormous amounts of money. He was constantly on TV. But he's one of these people who, you know, has really faded a lot. And for me, the animation work, the voice work is the thing which, you know, more than Bewitched, more than I Dream of Jeannie, really speaks to me still. And, you know, the life he brought to these characters, I think, is incredible.
You said that 5 years ago you started thinking about this project. I guess that's how long it takes to make a film in Britain these days.
Yeah. I mean, it's taken... Yeah, it's at least 5 years. It's at least 5 years. I mean, it was a very... You know, I'm an artist filmmaker as well, so I suppose I work, you know, in a slightly different way in that, you know, I pick up bits of money from here and there and do a lot of research. Research is really kind of important to me. I've been working with an animator for about the last 10 years. And the way that we work together is he tends to do a few scenes and then I go away and think about stuff and then come back to it. So it's, you know, it's partly the kind of process as well in that I do, it's been drawn out for a reason. And then of course there's been a lot of kind of American shoots, you know, and going back and reassessing things and thinking, actually, we can't use that. I want to do this instead. So there is that kind of sense of it being a longer process because of the way that I work, but it is also because of the fact that, I think as an artist filmmaker, you're not dealing with big budgets. You're dealing with much smaller budgets, and you have to find kind of creative solutions to work with not much money, basically.
But also in America, they seem to have more reverence for old Hollywood, for old animation, and aspects of pop culture like that. So was it easier actually to get American money to part fund this project than it was British?
No, not at all. Really? We didn't have any American money at all. I mean, partly because I didn't really look there. But also because we decided kind of early on to... that it would be strategically probably kind of a better situation for me just to kind of work with the contacts I had in terms of funding and to develop those contacts, to get money from those contacts. So the American side of it's been, you know, I mean, it is obviously a film about an American subject, but it's also, got a certain amount of kind of Britishness to it. And, you know, it's the whole side of, you know, we have an American co-producer as well. So there is a kind of, but it is a British production.
Well, that's one of the things that I like about the film is that you have British academics talking about Americano, and it's nice having the two kind of aspects to, you know, examining culture.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wanted, as I said, I didn't want this to be a biopic of Paul Lynde. I really wanted to use the voice casting of the cartoon villains by Paul Lynde as a starting point for the film, and then really to kind of, you know, more akin to a kind of essay film, go off and think about, you know, aspects of hysterical masculinity, aspects of, you know, the Hanna-Barbera Serbic villains, the way that voice is used as a signifier of otherness, you know, certainly in the case of Paul Lynde, but in, you know, lots of other cases. And also, of course, hysterical laughter. Hysterical laughter was very much, in a way, hysterical laughter was the starting point for the work, because in terms of funding, because I had money from Wellcome, and worked with a scientist, Sophie Scott, who is a neurologist and who works with voice and is a, you know, has done a lot of research into laughter. So our initial conversations were all about hysterical laughter and about, you know, very specifically the hysterical laughter of the cartoon villain. But yeah, I wanted it to kind of, the film in some ways to expand outwards and to look at these various different things which came up, and, you know, not to be a biopic and not just to be centred on Lynde, really.
How did you find the experience of moving from short films to something that's almost feature length?
Interesting. I've now completely in love with long format or feature, whatever you want to call it. But it's hard. It really is hard, partly because of, you know, when you've spent most of your career making, you know, 5 to 10 minute films, and then suddenly you're making something which is, you know, 70, 80 minutes, that the sense of how much material you need is kind of all over the place. I also think the way that the way that I work, I'm not necessarily working in a way whereby I'm storyboarding everything and deciding, okay, so this is definitely going to follow that, etc., etc. It's more exploratory. So I might, you know, record an interview and then find out that actually there's only this bit of the interview or that bit of the interview which is actually relevant. So it's very much, yeah, it's very much an exploratory process. So that sense of how much material you need is difficult. But on the other hand, you know, you have all of these kind of, you have a very different situation in terms of the way that the film is disseminated. You know, you're when you're working with, you know, feature length work, it's a very different thing from the way that you might disseminate a short film. So that side of it, I find really interesting, and also find really interesting in, you know, the post-production process. And a lot of my work has always been kind of formulated within the edit. So, and this is no, you know, was no exception at all. So that thing of finding the film within the edit, you know, obviously in a 70 minute film is just a longer, more expansive kind of process. And, you know, that's something which I enjoyed, really.
So the film is going on this sort of short tour around the UK at the moment. What's the plans for it afterwards? Will there be a DVD, TV screenings, etc.? Or is that up in the air?
Okay. I hope so. I don't know. I mean, at the moment, we had the world premiere at London Film Festival in October in the Experimenter programme. We then had the international premiere at Rotterdam in January. We have got some other screenings lined up, which I can't talk about yet because they've not been kind of officially announced. And so hopefully it will do more festivals. And during that process, hopefully, you know, there will also be other kind of possibilities which, you know, which pop up. But in a way, it's, I mean, although I think it's quite a kind of, it's a bit of a slow burner of a project, you know, it's picking up things in interesting places. So I'm feeling kind of, you know, very positive about the way that things are developing.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Doozy is currently doing the festival circuit in the UK, with screenings taking place on the 30th of April at Exeter Phoenix, on the 4th of May at Flatpack Festival in Birmingham, on the 7th of May at the University of Warwick, and on the 9th of May at the Phoenix in Leicester. For more information about all of these screenings, please go to lmfyffproductions.com. That's lmfyffproductions.com. And you can follow the film on Twitter at doozyfilm. That's at D-O-O-Z-Y film. Richard's earlier work with the comic collective Let Me Feel Your Finger First, including such animated shorts as Francis and Ontologically Anxious Organism, can be found on their website, letmefeelyourfingerfirst.com. In the second half of today's show, I'm talking to animator Simon Quinn. Simon has a long history in animation, working on classic British TV shows such as Spitting Image and Fireman Sam, and recently has been a line producer and animation producer on brilliant Hollywood movies such as The Fantastic Mr. Fox and Isle of Dogs, directed by Wes Anderson, and Frankenweenie, directed by Tim Burton.
So, as you know, I came along to your talk at the Phoenix a few weeks ago, and I was really struck by how animation wasn't necessarily a career that you intended to enter. It was more that because you like to make things, and indeed started out as a potter, you kind of ended up as an animator in a sort of sideways way by making moulds for Spitting Image.
Correct, yes. It's a very sideways way of getting into an industry.
But presumably once you found yourself in Spitting Image, there was something then about the animation industry that kind of struck you and you thought, oh, maybe this is the way my life is heading.
It was basically Spitting Image started to do animated segments in I think it was series 4. And there was a chap called Jeff Newitt from Aardman's who came up to do the animation, and I watched him working, and we had to make lots and lots of puppets very quickly. I think we were doing between 10 to 70 puppets a week. And because it was very rapid, I learned an awful lot very quickly from what worked and what didn't work. And also what was very interesting for me was Spitting Image was made up of about 150 people, and you were compartmentalized into one specialism. Whereas with animation, I got to make the armature, do the foam making, do the painting, make the costume. So I actually got to do a lot of disciplines, and I found that more interesting. It sort of appealed to my nature as a maker, that I wasn't just going to... I mean, making moulds is pretty horrible, smelly, dirty work. Whereas if you can move between different departments and you get to experience lots of different things, you kind of think, oh, these are more exciting. So, and I was also very young, so I wasn't really sure exactly what I wanted to do, so I thought, well, let's try anything. And I think that's what I found exciting, is you could try anything you wanted to, nobody told me I couldn't do it.
Well, and it sounds in a way like it had a real educational quality to it. So, for example, in this country, if you want to do a degree in fine art, you do a one-year course called a foundation course, where you try your hand at photography, ceramics, printmaking, painting, and so on, to find out what discipline suits you best. And in a way, it sounds like you were doing something similar at Spitting Image.
Yes, that's almost a repeat of what I did, because I also did the foundation course. So, yes, and again, it's that thing about... multi-disciplines. I think I'm a good painter. I think I'm a good sculptor. I think I'm a good armature maker. So because I had many strings to my bow, and also part of it was I like solving problems. I think this is one of the things that more than anything, solving problems is actually a key thing to keeping your brain working. So again, I find that really exciting. If somebody sets me a problem and says, how do we do this? I really like figuring out how we do it. So and animation poses those problems all the time. It's it's a fascinating place to go.
Mm. Well, and indeed, as well as actually making puppets and being involved in the production side of animation, along the way, you were being innovative in terms of the actual kind of form of animation, in terms of creating new kinds of silicon molds and new armature that animation could be done with. So presumably you were thinking of how innovation might enter the industry at the same time as you were involved with making things.
Yeah, I think one of the things as well is it's crossing over from live action into animation. Mm. I'd learned about materials and I'd learned about new materials, which, for instance, we came across a substance called plastizote, which was actually used in car doors as a sound barrier. And it's very lightweight, doesn't add anything to the car, but when you shut the door, it makes a nice, pleasing, more thuddy sound rather than tin. But it's also carvable. And so it had the similar properties to balsa wood. So we figured out we could use it for feet, and you could put pins through it because it was rigid and hard. And if you stuck a bit of wire in it and used it as a foot and stuck a pin in it, suddenly you could make a puppet stand up and walk around, much in the way that the Wombles did. They had balsa wood feet. And so it had similar properties. So, it was just sort of looking at it and thinking, oh, that's an interesting material. Why don't we try to do this? And it worked. And then it's sort of because me and my wife, who also worked at Film Affair together, we like to try all these different materials out. We then took that knowledge to other companies. Specifically, she became head of model making at Aardman's. So when we went to work down there, we were bringing things that we'd learnt in our area to Bristol. And again, Bristol didn't have necessarily a lot of people moving around, so they were using materials that were local to them. So again, it's like pollinating. You're sort of basically, you're taking things with you. We found epoxy resins that people had never used before. We used them in the mold making industry to fix things. And we took those with us, ways of working with aluminium wire, where we twisted it in a drill to create arms and legs. People hadn't done that before, and I learned that making full large armatures at Spitting Image to support sculpt. So there's all sorts of things that just become how you apply something, and somebody sort of comes along and says, oh, why don't you do that? You think, oh, yeah, why don't we? And a lot of the most exciting people you meet, because you meet a lot of interesting people in model making, are problem solvers, and they come from very different disciplines. It could be car mechanics, or they might have been a carpenter, or they were good with their hands, and they sort of fall into it by accident. But they bring a certain skill and a way of looking at things, and everybody's knowledge starts to contribute. Again, it's very exciting.
Mm. So I was going to ask, how did you come across a material that is used for packing car doors? Was it because there was a car mechanic on the team?
Funny enough, it was we were making a nuclear button and a wardrobe that had to be worn as a prop. I think it was in the title sequence, and we needed a lightweight material. And one of the chaps who worked in the engineering department actually knew this material and introduced us to it. And again, it's just pure accident that somebody sort of says, oh, why don't you try this? And you go, oh yeah, why not? it's often things would be lying around where you somebody else was using it for some other reason, and you just sort of you discover it by accident, and your natural curiosity leads you to try something that maybe you shouldn't. I mean, there are lots of things where we failed, where we tried new materials and they didn't work, and you'd have to sort of rethink things. One of the things that plastizote didn't like doing was going in ovens, and we used to use it as and the bodies to fill them out, and because plastic has lots of air in it, the air used to expand in the oven and cause air bubbles. So we had to learn a way of sort of wrapping things in cling film to protect them. It's all sorts of things. You try it and something goes wrong, and you think, oh, how do I solve that problem? And you try something else, and you sort of evolve processes by accident, or sort of accident, trial and error, I think is probably a better way of saying it. A lot of materials, other people would be, you know, they'd have a stock or a supply of something, and it just happened to be the only thing to hand. So you might just use it because it was there. Mm. not very scientific.
Well, indeed. So amongst your credits, throughout the 90s, you worked on a number of British cartoons such as Huxley Pig, Astro Farm, Pib and Pog. But I suppose the one that is most dear to a lot of people's hearts is that you were involved with the revival of the Wombles. And speaking of materials, I was fascinated to find that you were able to track down the original clothing that the Wombles once wore to use them on the new models as well.
Yes, we were very, very lucky. Film Fair is quite a small family. In fact, you know, there's only a few animation companies which did stop frame at the time. And everybody very much knows each other. Sort of as one person's leaving, the other people come in. And Ivor Wood, who'd gone off to do, I think, Charlie Chalk at the time, was still active, and we still had his number in a Rolodex. And we phoned up his studio, and his wife answered, and we said, do you know where you got the material for the Wombles, which was their sort of golden fur colour? And she said, oh, yes, my husband and I were on holiday in Edinburgh. And we were walking up Princess Street, and we walked into this shop, and she, on her Rolodex, because it was very old-fashioned, she pulled out the telephone number, and we rang up the shop and spoke to this very lovely lady who'd been running the shop for over 40 years. And she said, oh, I was waiting for your call. I've been keeping that material for the last 30 years. Would you like some? And we said, of course we would. And she said, oh, it's ever so expensive now. The price has gone up. It's about £6 a metre. Are you sure you can afford it? And we were like, wow, this is amazing. So this very lovely lady sent us a couple of metres of Womble material, which she kept on a shelf in her shop all those years. It's absolutely fantastic. It's sort of a wonderful set of, you know, serendipity and coincidences that allow these things to happen. And you know, one of the privileges of even restarting something like the Wombles was we got our hands on some of the original models and got to take them apart, and we discovered how they were made. And in fact, Ivor Wood and his wife made them on their kitchen table, and you know, the heads were made out of paper mache. So when we opened them up, we could actually read the newspaper headlines of the day. And the eyes were made of newspaper that was painted pink, and the little bits like confetti fell out of the head. They were like replacements. And you could even, you know, you could see pictures from the 1970s or bits of typeface. It was, you know, it was absolutely wonderful looking at things and seeing how people have tried to solve problems before you, and then thinking, you know, it's a bit like re-engineering a car or a chair or something. It's like, you know, lots of people have done it, and then you've got to sort of rethink it and redo it without spoiling it or you know, for people. So although the Wombles looked as they were when they were new, a lot of the mechanics inside and the way that we approached it was very new. So, you know, we were very respectful of the work, because they were beautifully made puppets, you know. And they served them well, so we wanted ours to be, you know, just as good, and you know, and hopefully they were, and did the service, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you're a person who is obviously very much in love with the form of stop motion animation, and it's great that it's something that continues to exist on the big screen and small, but it feels like you're always fighting against the rival CGI movement. So for example, you brought back Fireman Sam for a series in 2005 as stop motion, and then that would get revamped again as CGI a few years later. So it's almost like there is a market for it out there, but there's always pressure on studios to do it cheaper via computer.
Yes, I think it's not so much cheaper by computer so much as I think there's the American studio system, and they understand volume, and it's based along sort of the traditional 2D, where you can have 600 artists drawing a Bugs Bunny, and if all of them learn how to draw the Bugs Bunny, then essentially they can all work on 600 desks. And I think where CG is easier for producers to understand, and certainly studios to understand, is CG, you can share the assets and you can have multiple people working all at the same time. And in stop frame, you can only build so many puppets because of the cost and shooting so many units. And so scalability of a production is actually very difficult. And I think certainly CG proves much more for, you know, certainly for the American producers, that it's very much like the 2D system. So you can have multiple people working in multiple locations, all sharing the same asset. It doesn't actually cost you anything because once the asset's been created, it can be shared desk to desk. Whereas if I make a puppet and it costs £10,000, the next one costs £10,000 and the next one costs £10,000. So it doesn't work in a scalable way. I think that's why CG essentially has taken over. And also they've done a very, very good job in replicating now stock frame. So if you look at Magic Light Pictures did the Gruffalo not so long ago, and I spent a long, long time looking at the puppets and trying to work out whether it was CG or whether or not it was stock frame. And they were very, very clever. What they'd actually done is shot real small-scale sets with lighting effects and then composited in a CG character, which they'd actually scanned from an original plasticine painted model. Huh. So they cheated on many levels, but actually the animators then did a very nice job of actually making it look like stock frame. And, you know, to be honest, that's sort of the death nail in your coffin when people can copy exactly what you do. But there's a certain physicality and charm to stock frame, which I think people in the CG world still struggle with. And I think a lot of it is also things like pure accident. When an animator in stock frame works, their performance is a performance, much like a dancer. They can only do it once, so when they do a shot, it can't be repeated. As in, you can't go back a few frames and then keep on mucking about with it, or send it up to somebody else in a committee and have them all sit around and pull the levers and change it. You know, the performance is the performance. So if you want to reshoot it, you just have to reshoot that shot. So there is a certain, you know, there's a certain thing. I think also when you watch Ray Harryhausen's films, you'll see he used to pre-drill the holes in a set for his puppets to hit the mark. And sometimes you'll see the dinosaurs sliding towards a hole, which gives them a very particular movement or gait, not just the jerkiness, but also things that he was trying to hit marks and he was shooting blind. And again, there's oodles of charm that just come from those sort of small details and small accidents that happen. And they can only happen in, you know, in a physical world, not necessarily in a computer world, which is even more controlled, you know.
Well, I was wondering, you spoke about Ray Harryhausen, and an even earlier example, which you showed at your talk a few weeks ago, was a Victorian animator who was using dead insects as puppets in their films, which is a particular kind of example of actually kind of reviving an inanimate object, in this sense literally bringing something back from the dead.
Yes, I think that was Starovich, wasn't it? So again, that comes down to people finding things. So I think when you find an insect, it's a bit like a crab, you know, if you find an insect which actually already articulates and has hinges and actually is almost the right scale for the film you want to make. I can just see in his mind him looking at a cricket going, well, if I move it, it moves. If I just put a little bit of wire in it and it could stand up, then effectively I've got a working puppet. So I can see his thought process, you know, just in the mechanics of not having to make a model. But he did make tiny clothes, which I thought was absolutely, you know, but maybe he got them off of a doll set. So again, it might be that he was just using found objects. I don't think I've got any detail on his methodology, unfortunately. But yes, it's anything that comes to hand. I mean, one of the things about stock frame again is, you know, moving inanimate objects, making them come to life is essentially, that's where the magic is for me. The fact that you could walk into a room and animate an entire tea set sitting on a table and not have to do anything apart from just watch them all magically move and make up a story is absolutely fascinating. And then walk into that same room and they're just these dead objects. So it is, you know, all that stuff comes out of the imagination of one person's head. So, you know, I think that's what it really is. It really does feel like alchemy. It feels a little bit like it's magic, and you wonder, you know, how, you know the process, but you still wonder how these things actually look like they're alive. I suppose that's it. And to your point, you know, this technique is as old as film itself. It goes, you know, back beyond 1906, and people were really just trying to even figure out, you know, how the cameras worked and how lighting worked, and they certainly didn't have things like video assist. So everything was in their imagination while they were working out these techniques. They would never know what they'd shot until they opened the film and got it exposed and developed it. So even to them, it would have been a surprise that it actually worked. And I'm sure there's lots and lots of rolls of film that didn't make it into the archives of all the experiments where it went very badly wrong, where it didn't look like animation while they were trying to figure it out, you know. So, we stand very much on the shoulders of other people, you know. There's always people that have gone before us that have tried things, and you know, if you look hard enough, probably nothing is new in that sense.
You spoke about how some classic British TV shows were basically just one person working in their shed, and then they would churn out like however many episodes and hand them into the BBC. I guess when you worked on shows like Fireman Sam, that sort of process has been scaled up to a whole team of people. When you then worked on movies like Frankenweenie and Fantastic Mr. Fox, was that then scaled up again, that the team and the resources was much larger for a film shoot than it would be for a TV show?
Yeah, it's a good point. So in the early days of animation, especially like, you know, the example of the Wombles and Ivor Wood, it would have been a very, very small team indeed. You know, husband, wife, maybe another animator or two, a lighting camera guy if the animator or director didn't do it themselves. So there may have been, you know, a team of 5, 6, maybe 7 or 8 if they were lucky. Fireman Sam, we had a team of 26. That's just in the studio. And when we scale up to a feature film, I'm looking at 260 plus people. I mean, there may be 600 people may work on the film, but on the actual studio floor in edit and VFX, we may have at any one time well over 200 people physically in the studio. So yeah, it's 10 times as big.
Wow.
It's an interesting trying to apply scale. I think it's the same as like cooking. It doesn't necessarily work, but you've got to kind of put all the ingredients together and then try and figure out who works best together. And films work really because you have very good HODs. So you have, you know, a head of puppets or a DOP, and they'll basically build a team around themselves, have their own heads of departments, and it scales down sort of pyramid-like. It always starts for me with a core of people. So the initial core will probably be only 8 to 10 heads of department who essentially they're making the film. And then their deputies and all the people below them, how they transfer that down. It's sort of like orchestrating, so as a good example, it might be sort of five people fiddling, five people at oboeing, five people on the harp, you know, it's that kind of thing of making sure that everyone knows what they're doing, hoping everyone knows what they're doing. Making a film is a really interesting thing. It's slightly different to television also in the sense that there's only one script to worry about and you have to get that right. Whereas with a children's series, for instance, if you've got 52 episodes, you do have to really keep it moving. And if one episode isn't as good as another, it doesn't really matter because you've got a lot of them to get through. But a film will only live and die on its own script, unfortunately. So you've really got to work very hard to get it right and make sure it's the best it can be. And I think that's one of the things about setting up a feature film is making sure that your team are all going and pulling in the right direction. They all got to pull in one way.
But I mean, you know, I guess also one of the reasons why you'd need hundreds of people on the film is that just to get it made, several shots would be shot simultaneously in different parts of the studio, just that there's enough output coming from the studio.
Yes, so we start off small and grow it. It doesn't start as an instantaneous large monster, but When we're in full production, we could have upwards of 35 to 45 shooting units with 28 animators all going at the same time.
Wow.
And we're trying to maximize footage. So we're full swing, we're trying to aim for 2 minutes a week. And, you know, it's always about prepping the next set. So the animator is shooting on one set, and then as soon as they finish, they've got somewhere else to go so that they're always working. And yes, it's a mind-boggling amount of information to juggle and to make sure continuity works between... I mean, what I find fascinating is how, you know, 10 animators all know that Mr. Fox works and acts in a certain way, and they've all learnt his mannerisms so that from shot to shot, Mr. Fox doesn't behave not like Mr. Fox, if you see what I mean, so that you don't watch a shot and go, oh, he doesn't behave like that. He feels like a different person. And that's kind of what's really interesting about a film is all the animators having to learn characters. So lead animator would take Mr. Fox and would do a few shots and show people all the mannerisms and work out with the director how he would act. And then they share that information, and then everyone has to sort of go to sort of an acting school for Mr. Fox and learn that, and they all share information about it. And that's also fascinating. The fact that you can watch a film and all the characters behave in a consistent way is also, you know, a credit to the animation team.
I wonder, in a way, with the fantastic Mr. Fox, if you kind of made a rod for your own back, because comparing that film with Isle of Dogs, there's a certain number of locations in Mr. Fox, and then in Isle of Dogs, it feels like there's twice as many, some of which might only last on screen for a couple of seconds. And so presumably that also provides additional work that needs to be done before you can even start shooting.
Yes, that's a good point. So what tends to happen is I'm often given the same budget for each film, regardless of how much time has elapsed or what the exchange rate is. And what happens is each film is completely different, as in the Isle of Dogs is very much a road movie. So therefore the characters were on a journey and they kept changing location over and over again. And I think for Mr. Fox, we did something like 175 locations. Whereas on Isle of Dogs, I think we were up to 230, 240. But the budget wasn't greatly different, and we'd sort of gone 10 years later. So it's trying to figure out how to make things and be economical about it. And also lots of cheating went on. We did a lot of false perspective sets where we had multiple sets. Sometimes they were sculptural. They might have only been 4 or 5 inches deep. You know, we had a fantastic sculptor who actually sculpted 5 locations, which all were on screen for only a couple of seconds. And it was a way of sort of graphically illustrating a change of location, but not actually going to the whole hog of building it 80 feet by 80 feet, you know. So, yeah, it's the challenges that you're given. So, you know, at the breakdown, the team is really thinking about how much money have I got to spend, and where does the money look best on screen? And everyone really is trying to give their best to that. So you don't want to spend all your budget on a 1 second shot when you've got a location that's on screen for a couple of minutes. So you really want the money to go to the right places. So people are very good at kind of problem solving and trying to really think through economical ways of giving the director what he wants, but also, you know, not letting you down in the art direction as well, making it also look beautiful, you know. So, filmmaking is problem solving. Like, literally, it's one giant problem that needs to be broken down into lots of little problems. I think the way that we approach everything is one step at a time, and try and think about the journey as being small steps, and don't be overwhelmed by the whole thing, but have it in your mind that there's sort of there's an arc to the whole process.
And then working with Tim Burton on Frankenweenie, that was a film that was in black and white and was also screened in 3D. So did either of those things change the way that you would shoot and light an animated film?
It was interesting because I think the DOP approached it. when we start off with our, I'm talking about our heads of department here, the art department and the art director discussed this with the director of photography, and essentially they did some experimentation with colour, because back in black and white days, there were certain colours that tonally just didn't make a difference. So we actually painted sets in black and white paint. You would get, you know, the right and correct tonal differences for shooting in black and white, so that things actually, objects actually stood out where they wouldn't in colour. So again, there was a learning process of almost relearning how black and white was shot. So that was an interesting step. And the art department came up with a whole range of sort of a colour palette of blacks, greys, whites, greens, blues, and various different hues that would work, and other colours that we couldn't use at all because they wouldn't work in black and white. They just didn't show up. So that was really interesting. So we were relearning a process that had almost been forgotten back in the 60s. And then the 3D element, funnily enough, it was a bit of a fad, and therefore people wanted us to adopt it, but it wasn't at first part of the remit for making the film. So it wasn't designed to be a 3D film from the outset. And in actual fact, we didn't shoot it in 3D. The 3D was actually done as a post process. In lots of ways, it was quite interesting because we weren't actually designing it to be a 3D film, but it worked very well in 3D, surprisingly. But I think that might be because it was in black and white and there was lots of contrast. I couldn't tell you I understand the process exactly, but some very clever computers did it for us. Whereas I think with Coraline over at Leica in America, they actually developed a process where they had all their cameras on a mini motion control rig, which moved 7 degrees to imitate left eye, right eye. And they did actually take 2 frames for every 1 frame, and then they had to do 2 frames of post. So it was a true 3D film. And we decided that would be way, way too expensive. It would have been a lot of money that we didn't have. So, yes, the post approach was adopted.
In terms of your credits in animation, you're listed on some films as animation producer, on others as line producer, and on others just as producer. Is there any particular difference between those roles, or is it basically just making sure that everyone does their jobs?
There's subtle differences. As a producer, I will be responsible for the entire project, also raising the funding.
Wow.
And hiring all the creative people, including the director and the writers. So essentially, in my producer role, all the responsibility on whether the project succeeds is on me. When I'm working for other people as a line producer, essentially I'm working for somebody else who has raised the money already, either through a studio or themselves, and then they will be instructing me on how they want it, and I will be taking their budget and their instructions and then trying to make it work. And also they can fire me. That's a slightly different thing. So I am an employee in that sense. I am employed by them to do that job. So that's sort of a difference in that sense. And a line producer essentially is responsible for running the budget with the producer and the production accountant. It's a triumvirate of responsibility. And I will basically break down the schedule and the milestones, and they will tell me what the delivery date is, and I'll work back all the departments and try and figure out where the budget should be spent and what we need to do. And then they may have hired a lot of the HODs, so I'm not responsible necessarily for hiring the crew at that level, but I am responsible for then hiring the crew and the contracts below that, if you see what I mean. So Wes Anderson, for instance, will choose the DOP he wants to work with, and he will choose the editor he wants to work with, and he'll write the script himself. And then when I'm brought on, those are decisions that I have to work with. There is a difference, but being the producer is possibly the most fun in the sense that you actually get to choose all the elements because it's your project.
Mm. So what would an average day be for you on the set as a line producer?
We tend to start at around 7:15 in the morning. And I would check the emails from the day before, and I would meet my coordinator to see if the studio was up and running, because we have a sort of a shift system, because we're open from 7 in the morning until 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And then we would go to rushes, which would be at 8 o'clock, where we would see what had happened the day before, see all the footage. The HODs would watch it, everyone would give their comments, and instructions would go down to the floor from the first AD. And then we would start a round of various meetings where I'm basically visiting different departments, talking to the heads of departments, seeing what issues they have, organising meetings and setting up essentially the systems to run the company. So it sort of then turns into sort of quite a boring day, but it's a day of meetings and organising and emails. And then get to the end of the day and go home, probably get home about 9 o'clock at night, have something to eat and go to bed. So, yes, they're very long days. It goes on for about 2.5 years. And wow. My wife and my son think I'm a stranger during that period.
And one thing that amazed me when you were talking about your role before is that the level of particularity of certain jobs, that, for example, there's someone whose role is just to check that all the little bulbs on the set work, because otherwise, if one goes out, you might not notice until another week's worth of footage has been shot.
Yes. So, yes, funny enough, that... that job got replaced by a computer. We used to hire an electrician to go around every set in the morning, and their job was just to check that every single bulb on the lighting map was still active from the day before, for that very reason, because if somebody didn't notice a bulb had gone, a shot would be ruined. There is now our gaffer, who's our lead electrician, discovered a machine that was used in theatres where a little alarm would be triggered, and it was zonal, so it would actually tell you which set the bulb had gone in. And so even if he didn't know exactly which bulb it was, he knew what location it was in. So of the 46 sets, he'd be going to the right set to find the bulb that had gone, because a little alarm had told him about it. But there are all sorts of technical issues that happen to do with lighting and temperature and humidity, where the lights all have to get to the correct temperature before you start shooting, and the sensors in the camera have to get to the right temperature before you start shooting. And the sets expand and contract with moisture and heat, so depending on what time of day it is, we have levels and little pointers set where the camera is, so that we can actually make sure that the set isn't being shot on and the puppet hasn't dropped a centimetre or two. So yes, there's all sorts of checking and rechecking that's done, which is why we run a shift system where we have people coming in early who can start those processes off, and people who finish late while animators are finishing off shots. But yeah, all films are very, very technical, not just creative. So, you know, there's many clever people who think about these things that other people aren't thinking about, which is why we hire them.
Indeed. So what's next in terms of the animated projects you've got coming up that you're allowed to talk about?
I'm working on two at the moment. I'm working on Paddington, which is... The Adventures of Paddington, which is a TV series which is currently in production for Nickelodeon, which I think has been announced. I can talk about it.
Yes.
And that will be coming out in 2020. We We've just started animating our first episode. It's full CG. It's been done at a studio called Blue Zoo here in the UK in London. They're very, very good. And I'm also working with another company called Magic Light Pictures, and I'm working with a company called Triggerfish doing the animation for The Snail and the Whale, which is a Julia Donaldson and Alex Scheffler adaptation of their epic poem, The Snail and the Whale, which Triggerfish are based in Cape Town in South Africa. They've worked on the previous three productions, and they do beautiful work. But they are all full CG. They are not stop frame.
Okay.
I'm also on a learning curve as well. I've decided to go over to the dark side and give it a go. But the production, the organisation, and the way that things run is all very familiar.
Mm.
One of the things I'm really enjoying working on Paddington is I work with the script writers, and I'm sort of running the script department, which is great. It's a very, very creative role, and the scripts are lovely, and it's going to be hopefully beautiful, and people are going to love it. It's Paddington is a very precious property, and there's a lot of affection for Michael Bond's books, and we have a lot of responsibility on our shoulders not to muck it up, basically.
Well, I've seen some production art from the series, and obviously, rendering every individual hair on Paddington's body is something that you can do with the budget of a feature film, but maybe not with a TV show. So the look has been simplified a little for TV. But I guess as long as, you know, the script and the style is simpatico with the films, then that's the most important thing.
Yes, the brief for this one is that Paddington should be for a younger audience, so it's preschool. And it's their entry point into the Paddington world. They won't be aware of the films when you're one, two, or three. and certainly in 2020, they're unlikely to have seen them. So it's the starting point for getting into Paddington. And I think we've worked very closely with Heyday, who make the feature films. And, they've been very particular about his shape and form, if not fur. But again, we're going for a faux stop frame style. And if I made him furry, which I could, I'd be trying to fix it down with hairspray or some form of crusty gel. or the approach that we've taken is to treat him like a sculpted foam latex puppet, which I think works really, really well. So it has the advantages of looking like a stop frame puppet, but moves like a CG character, so it's a really nice combination, and we sort of also tried to stay with the kind of the 2D 3D aspect. The original Paddington was two-dimensional backgrounds and a stop frame bear and stop frame props, and the world was very beautiful. It was actually done for budgetary reasons, because it was cheaper, apparently, than building all the sets. So we've kind of used a little bit of that as well. And from the feature films, they did a homage to the original series in a pop-up book. And we used that as our inspiration as well. So, you know, it's got an awful lot going for it. And I think, people should be pleased. I'm hoping they're going to be pleased with our treatment.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's all right.
My interview with Simon was inspired by a talk of his that I heard at the Phoenix in Brighton. At the Phoenix, they have monthly talks by people working in the entertainment industry, and their next Cred talk is taking place on Wednesday the 29th of May, featuring screenwriter, producer and actor Graham Duff, who worked on such shows as Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible, Ideal and Count Arthur Strong. That's taking place on Wednesday the 29th of May from 6 p.m, and you can get tickets by going to phoenixbrighton.org/events. For more information about Simon Quinn's work, please go to bigfatstudio.co.uk, and you can buy the films The Fantastic Mr. Fox, Isle of Dogs and Frankenweenie on Blu-ray, where all shiny discs are sold. The Electric Sheep Film Show was recorded, edited and introduced by Alex Fitch, and is a Panel Borders production. You can find all previous episodes at www.panelborders.wordpress.com, and we'll be back on air in 2 months' time. Thanks for listening.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.